Rock the Lakefront June 13th and 14th as Racine Harbor Fest returns for two unforgettable days of live music, mouthwatering food, and nonstop fun. Advance tickets $8, VIP tickets still available online at racineharborfest.com.
I'm Peter King. So far it appears to be quiet, but more protests on immigration enforcement are expected today in Los Angeles. 2,000 National Guard troops are there under orders from President Trump after yesterday's demonstrations turned violent. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem on CBS's Face the Nation.
The president chose the safety of this community over waiting for Governor Newsom to get some sanity. And that's one of the reasons why these National Guard soldiers are being federalized.
The Democrat Bernie Sanders spoke about Trump's ordered deployment on CNN's State of the Union.
The governor of California, the mayor of the city of Los Angeles, did not request the National Guard, but he thinks he has a right to do anything he wants.
CBS's Bradley Blackburn.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted on X, this federal response is because of violent mob assaults on ICE and federal law enforcement as they conduct immigration raids. CBS News has learned that there is increased immigration enforcement going on, an average of 1,500 daily arrests last week.
The last time National Guard troops were federalized in this kind of situation was also in Los Angeles in 1992 after the police beating of Rodney King. The latest CBS News poll shows 45% of those responding approve of the overall job President Trump is doing. That's unchanged from the last survey done to mark his first 100 days in office. Trump gets mixed marks in more specific areas. Deputy Surveys Director Jennifer DePinto.
On issues, the president continues to get higher marks on his handling of immigration than he does on the economy and inflation.
Nearly 6 in 10 people say they disapprove of his tariffs and fear that they'll mean higher prices in the long run. The president's so-called big, beautiful bill is what precipitated the not-so-beautiful and very public breakup between Donald Trump and Elon Musk. House Speaker Mike Johnson tells ABC's This Week that Musk should realize that it's not all about him.
I didn't go out to craft a piece of legislation to please the richest man in the world. What we're trying to do is help hardworking Americans who are trying to provide for their families and make ends meet. Those are the people that are going to be excited about what this legislation produces.
There is no end in sight for the Gaza war. No sign either that Israel will allow the free flow of humanitarian aid to get into the region. Save the Children, U.S. President Yanti Sorpito tells CBS's Face the Nation many people there have simply lost hope.
The trauma is hard to overestimate. We're hearing mothers tell us that now their children are essentially waiting their turn to die.
Palestinian officials and witnesses say that Israeli fire has killed at least 12 people today headed toward a pair of aid distribution points in Gaza. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. As federal electric vehicle incentives face potential rollbacks, a new study is highlighting the burden of gasoline costs on Black and Latino drivers. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The Fuel Equity Report shows Blacks and Latinos are super users of gasoline, spending on average 15% of their paycheck to fuel their cars. The median household income for Blacks and Latinos in Wisconsin is between $31,000 and $46,000. Dr. Shelley Francis with EV Hybrid Noir says systemic factors like disinvestment in public transportation, economic segregation, and long commute times all contribute to the disproportionate impact.
They're also more likely on average to be driving these older, less fuel efficient cars due to income as well as financing barriers that they may experience.
The study says EV adoption could save Blacks and Latinos an average of $4,900 a year on fuel and maintenance, but barriers like affordability, charging access, and education persist. The report found the top 10% of Black and Latino gasoline users are generally concentrated in smaller cities and rural areas. The study suggests targeted policies to encourage equitable adoption of EV for Black and Latino communities, including enhancing purchase incentives, expanding financing options, and increasing charging infrastructure in communities where top gasoline users live. Francis says addressing the big misinformation gap about EVs is also crucial.
pushing more of those types of stories out there to show like the everyday driver. It's not some fancy person living out in a castle somewhere. It's just regular folks who are trying to work, make ends meet, and provide for their families.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. For your Sunday, some showers and storms around, increasing clouds, highs of the upper 60s, and a light south breeze. For tonight, showers ending, then skies turning mostly clear with lows in the mid-50s. Another chance of showers and storms on Monday, highs near 70, currently 65 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
At 5 p.m., I'll be joined with UW Wisconsin Law School professor Aaron Barbato to talk about immigration processes. We dispel myths and give you the real scoop.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, coming to you from Racine and Radio Park here, broadcast stations of Civic Media. But as always, inviting your questions, your comments, your inquiries, your observations into our discussion in this second hour of our weekend broadcast. That phone number, 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. Max, my producer, and I, delighted and honored you're spending some time with us in this weekend broadcast, talking all about the rule of law, specifically the latest bombshell blockbuster developments when it comes to deportations and due process in America, highlighted this past week by the announcement late this past week by the Attorney General that, yes, indeed, as you heard at the end of our first hour on this broadcast, that as she described him, Abrego Garcia is back in America. A number of observations, not only about that, but about the manner in which this was conducted. That is the public media announcement of what has happened. We know that he was brought back. He is here, apparently in Tennessee. He is in custody. He is presumably going to be the subject of future proceedings there in front of magistrate judges and district court judges to whom this case is now presented, because he is now a defendant in a federal court, having been on the receiving end of a federal indictment by a grand jury. That's our process. And that is the due process. He has the entitlement now to defend against that by filing the motions that Amy seek to file, by pursuing all of the mechanisms afforded to defendants, just as the prosecution under our system likewise afforded the mechanisms for going ahead to accurately, comprehensively, and yes, indeed, aggressively prosecute this case. The comments I make are not about the merits or demerits of the specific allegations. It is a laundry list. It is a laundry list of all kinds of things, almost superficially, seemingly responsive to many of the things that have been said about Abrego Garcia in recent weeks. They're all there. Question whether or not the content of this really does indeed focus exclusively on the conspiracy again to bring these undocumented aliens into the United States. But that, once again, the subject of another determination to be made by a grand jury after this is presented to a trial jury in a federal district court there in Tennessee. Why is that important as a factual matter? And the answer is, of course, because the very fact that our attorney general facilitated the return of Mr. Abrego Garcia to this nation means that for the past 3 months, In direct defiance to Judge Boasberg and others, the government could have done it all along. That's what Judge Boasberg was demanding just on Wednesday of this past week and for the previous weeks. That's what Judges Gallagher and Zinnes and Murphy have been asking for, specifically Judge Zinnes. She is the one who's been presiding over this case pending there in the District of Maryland. She is the one who's been commanding that the body, in the words of the habeas corpus language, be returned, and getting no response. And it turns out, of course, that the government could do it all along, and that affirms the contempt, the misbehavior, the misconduct of our government, even now as Mr. Abrego Garcia is back here. It reveals the lack of integrity and the lack of transparency, the lack of rightness by our government. And now doing this, seemingly an attempt, if you will, to justify their administrative error in the first place, which is exactly what the Department of Justice, the representatives before Judge Zinnes have previously said. This was an error, and Judge Zinnes said, correct that error, never done until now, and the basis of this indictment. That is a serious issue that will probably be the subject of further proceedings in front of Judge Zinnes, even as the criminal case proceeds in front of another judge in the Middle District of Tennessee. For now, the more important issue related to the things that my attorney general failed to say in any case, whether there is a defendant named Donald Trump or Hunter Biden or Eric Adams or Luigi Mangione, all those people previously been charged with federal offenses. What do the prosecutors always say? They always say to warn, to advise the public that the defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty. That is a fundamental proposition of every single prosecution, every single case that is presented to the American population, and also to a trial jury. It was missing, was it not, from the statement made by my attorney general? It arguably undermines the entire statement. You can even make representations, if you will, about the tone by which he described all of this and almost the self-justifying purpose for this indictment. Again, not in any way today commenting upon the merits. It may well be. It may well be, as Judge Wilkinson has said in the Fourth Circuit, as we read on this broadcast previously, it may well be that Mr. Abrego Garcia has done all of these things. He said, perhaps. Perhaps not. That's what a trial is all about. That's what a proceeding in front of a deportation judge, now a federal judge, is all about. Finally, apparently, the Department of Justice understood what Judge Wilkinson was saying many weeks ago in affirming what Judge Zinnes had done. Perhaps, but perhaps not. The point is, get this man back here and give him some due process. Now, we get him back here pursuant to the Supreme Court directive to facilitate his return in a mechanism that, frankly, few of us, if any of us, anticipated, a federal grand jury indictment that, again, raises the issue of what is the motive for doing this. That, too, can be the subject of a defensive motion alleging not only improper prosecutorial motive, but also based upon the representations made and not made in front of Judge Zinnes and arguably in front of Judge Boasberg as well, a misrepresentation that inheres in and is all about prosecutorial misconduct. Let's talk even more significantly about what Pam Bondi did say. She encapsulated, as did I, a lot of what is in this indictment. And that's the rule when it comes to announcing these kinds of things to the American public. You stay within the four corners of the document. That is legitimate. That is a statement that advises the public, the American population, what this is all about. You can go online and you can read the indictment. And I would say that most of the things that she said, even with her tone and even with the way in which she described them, there is foundation for them in the allegations in the indictment. It is significantly that during the course of her statement, she also said some things about Mr. Abrego Garcia that are not in the indictment, that are unmistakably intended merely to inflame. What did she say? She also said, nowhere in the indictment does this appear, that Mr. Abrego Garcia also solicited nude photographs of minor children.
That's child pornography. That does not appear in the indictment. She also went on to say that somehow he was involved in the murder of the mother of one of his co-gang members, one of the co-conspirators, also not in the indictment. There is an allegation of murder and all sorts of other things. But those kinds of very serious charges, the Attorney General of the United States of America decides to say these things out loud for one purpose, and that is to inflame the American population. The indictment speaks for itself. The government speaks through the statements made in court based upon the representations of fact, based upon evidence presented, the things put in pleadings. Those are the ways that the government, through integrity, presents these cases to the American population. I would offer to you for your consideration, regardless of what your political views and partisan perspectives may be, this is not any of that. This is an attorney general who failed to embrace, as she has failed to embrace in other situations, the fundamental notion that people charged with crimes are presumed innocent. Nothing about my statements indicate any belief, any conclusion. I know nothing more than you do about the content, the substance, the evidence to support those allegations. That's what a jury will find. All the more reason why my attorney general needed to reaffirm that notion and not add on these other very, very incendiary representations about child pornography and murder of a mother of a co-conspirator. As always, we appreciate your phone calls, your texts, your comments. We've got lots of folks coming in. Appreciate so much and value all of that. Dale calling in from Wausau this morning. Dale, glad to have you on the program this weekend.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Jim and Max. In this latest Supreme Court ruling, what I would like to know is why do six of the nine justices on the U.S. Supreme Court feel that the people of the U.S. have no right to privacy from this administration, Musk and his gang of 20-some-year-old kids in their forays into people's private information in the Social Security Administration, IRS, immigration, and probably various other U.S. departments. Your thoughts, Jim.
Dale, thank you so much for the comment, because we're getting to that next, always on the syllabus here. This is this major decision issued by the Supreme Court late this Friday, just this past week, indicating that indeed this so-called Musk team can, in fact, have access to sensitive records. Millions of Americans held by the Social Security Administration. Shadow docket, emergency application. We're going to get to that next, Dale, and talk exactly about what you've identified, which is the fact that six members of our Supreme Court believe that there should not be the privacy that's previously attended those documents. Thankfully, although not with compelling force in the end, three members say just the opposite. I'm going to spend some time talking about exactly what Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson said in support of your appropriate outrage, mine too. We'll get to that next. Dale, thanks for the call and the inquiry about all of that. Let's go next to Ollie. Ollie calling in also this weekend on our broadcast. Thank you for your comment, your question, your observation.
Well, I just was wondering, is it normal for them to have such fine details
in an indictment about, yes. Yeah,
yes. And seems to me like outrageously fine details. If they knew all this, why didn't they talk to the judge about this? Why weren't they forthcoming with all this information before? How did it just creep up now? And I was also wondering if anything has been said, now that he's back in the States, if he actually has the tattoos that on his hands that were supposedly photoshopped
on. About which the president spoke very notoriously not too long ago. Ollie, all great questions. Let me see if I can take them. As to the tattoos, we'll find out, presumably, as we see him appear and presumably get more now that he is back in the United States, admittedly through this mechanism we did not anticipate. As to the fine detail, often we do get indictments that have that fine detail. They're sometimes called talking indictments. This arguably is kind of a combination
of both of them. You don't have to allege all of that, but it's not improper to do so. My observation is that, again, this is an indictment that basically alleges alien smuggling and all these other things a part of it, arguably surplusage. And the detail is sometimes there in indictments. When we come back, I'll answer Ali's third question about the big question about why it is we're finding out about this now, as opposed to those hearings in front of Judge Zinnes. All of that as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation. 540 WAUK.
Medicare loses about $60 billion annually to fraud, errors, and abuse. June 2nd through the 8th is Medicare Fraud Prevention Week, focusing on the actions everyone can take to prevent, detect, and report Medicare fraud. Learn more by liking and following Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol on Facebook. Then visit our website, smpwi.org. For information and advice, remember, Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed two election bills May 2nd, one of which includes provisions for poll workers to challenge the citizenship of voters in the polling place, a ban on ranked choice voting, and a higher bar for third parties. Among several new provisions, House File 954 authorizes state election officials to access federal agency databases and gives local election officials authority to challenge citizenship of a registered voter at the polls. A recent presidential executive order now allows access to those databases. If a voter is not able to provide documentation at the polls, they would be forced to use a provisional ballot. Only days before the 2024 election, the Secretary of State's office challenged the eligibility of over 2,100 registered voters. Most were naturalized citizens or data errors, while 277 were registered non-citizens. Of those, only 35 voted out of 1.7 million ballots cast. Pro-voter groups argue such mass challenges intimidate legitimate naturalized citizens from voting. Two provisions in 954 attempt to protect major party power. It bans ranked choice voting for any election in Iowa and raises the bar for third parties to field candidates. Third parties now need to garner 2% of the vote in three consecutive elections to qualify for the ballot. We have more on HF 954 at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking in this segment, previous segments as well of Amicus Law Review, all about the return by a grand jury in the Middle District of Tennessee of a multi-page, two-count indictment against Abrego Garcia, alleging, importantly, what are the allegations? The unlawful transportation of undocumented aliens and also much related to that, conspiracy to transport aliens under various subsections of Title 8 of the United States Code. And that goes to one of the questions that Ali just asked, which is, what about all this detail about all these other crimes there? Well, again, it can be there if the grand jury does, in fact, make findings of all those kinds of things. Ali referred to it appropriately as the fine detail in here. It may be a part of a so-called talking indictment. Question whether or not it really needs to be there. What is the purpose of it being there if it doesn't directly support the principal focused allegations, again, of the transportation of aliens, the conspiracy to do so? It certainly fleshes things out, again, on the assumption that the allegations are true, if in fact they are proven at a trial. But I think, Ali, your observation is well taken, that we try typically in these circumstances to tailor an indictment around those things that will be specifically proven. And now the Department of Justice is arguably obliged to prove all of this. All of these other things that we have identified, that the Attorney General identified in the context of a trial about a much equally important but much narrower charge of undocumented alien transportation. An important point to recognize. And then the larger issue that Ali also identifies, which is we're finding out about this now. Why before? We played in part some portions of the follow-up questions. The press conference went on much beyond what we have played here on our broadcast. Played in part the questions that got us to that by the media, basically asking the Attorney General, why is this coming out now? When did this investigation start? She talked about the fact that, yes, his name and the notoriety, plainly in the case involving Judge Zinnes in her court, brought some light to him. And based upon that, going back and putting this together after, unmistakably after, all of this with respect to his deportation to El Salvador had begun in March, she indicated basically this started in April. Again, as the world, as the nation, as the government was talking about who this person is, now put together, perhaps, arguably, and this could well be the allegation in a motion to dismiss, a motion to challenge this prosecution. What is the purpose of doing this other than to justify the statements you previously made without support? Now you've got a grand jury, admittedly, who has acknowledged that these things happened. And it does, in fact, Ali, go back to your central point, which is, what do you say now to Judge Zinnes after all of this? Why didn't you come forward if you had all this previous information and provide her, even in camera, even without public disclosure, the things that you had? Make a proffer about what you had in connection with who this person is in response and in complete response to getting him back here. And that's the big point, right? Finally, the government exhibits its capacity to return Mr. Abrego Garcia to this country, something it could have done by March 20th, 5 days after he was transported there under arrest without due process, without the kinds of things that he's now going to be afforded very late in all this. Judge Zinnes, I'm sure, will have a lot of questions about what was going on in all these months, as will Judge Boasberg and arguably Judges Gallagher and Murphy as well. Not done with all of this. A lot more to come in that prosecution coming out of the Middle District of Tennessee. Much more also from my Attorney General, who again, in this instance, inflaming the population in a way that she does not need to do, in a way that actually is contrary to the best interest, not only of justice, but even the interest of the Department of Justice in getting a prosecution here. Because by saying these things beyond the scope of the indictment, going down these roads about things not alleged, you also tend to invite the very motion to strike, to dismiss, to challenge all of this based upon inappropriate prosecutorial misconduct. We'll see what happens. But big, big news coming out of the Department of Justice, coming out of all these courts, coming out of America in connection with due process and habeas corpus and the ways that under our Constitution we work in America. We also work in America, as you know well. We work in other ways with respect to the United States Supreme Court. All of that also, much of this also before the United States Supreme Court. We know that they have also reaffirmed on at least one, if not two occasions, the absolute obligation of the government to afford the Abrego Garcias of the world the due process that they are entitled to, and continues in some ways to address these issues as they percolate up from the lower courts into the appellate courts, finally into the United States Supreme Court. So from the Supreme Court as well, we will continue to hear a lot. We're also going to hear in just a moment or so about the other cases not involving deportation that the Supreme Court issued just this past week in other major areas of our lives and livelihoods. Before we get to that, a couple more callers. So appreciate the discussion this weekend in our broadcast. Gene, appreciate your being a part of our discussion. Calling in from Eau Claire. Always delighted to have you with us.
Always delighted to have you on every Saturday morning. Haven't missed one. Anyway, I want to see, now my family calls me Sherlock because I look at all the picture and want to figure things out.
And I think, do you take that as a compliment, right?
I don't know. Sometimes not. Okay, so anyway, with the thing coming out 3 weeks or 3 months later, okay, all of a sudden, remember, something in the bill that was passed by the House, you know, to weaken judges, you know, in this bill. And it just seems to me that it is like, oh, we're going to do this, and we have all this stuff on this guy, and you know what I mean? And try to make the judges that, you know, said you bring them back and this kind of thing, because they kind of throw things out in the air to confuse people.
And
anyway,
exactly,
that be related.
Jane. And we'll talk. Let me take that and answer that after our next break here, because it is interrelated with the legislation pending with respect to the authority of judges. And we'll talk more about that right after this break. Gene, thank you for the comment, the observation, the question. We'll continue right after this on Amicus Law Review.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Waukesha's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
CBS News Brief. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass is not happy about National Guard troops sent in by President Trump after violent immigration demonstrations there.
I am confident in our law enforcement partners here in Los Angeles that we can handle the situation. There is no need for 2,000 National Guard troops to come into our town.
Ukrainian President Zelensky tells ABC's This Week the recent drone attack on Russian bombers and fighter jets was devastating to Russia.
We think, and we have our analytics, that we destroyed 34% of their strategic air jets.
There is no sign that Israel will allow the free flow of humanitarian aid to get into Gaza again, save the children, U.S. President Yanti Sorpito on CBS's Face the Nation.
The humanitarian situation as it is completely untenable, that we're looking at mass starvation of innocent civilians and above all very young children.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
A special night for the Brewers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports at AmFam Field, where the Brewers and Padres weekend series wrapping up today. We'll have an update tonight. Now, last night, the Brewers winning 4-3, thanks to a walk-off home run by rookie Caleb Durbin, manager Pat Murphy.
Yeah, there was a lot of great performance tonight, both sides. It was well-pitched, and, you know, this is the type of resiliency that you got to have.
In 2021, Caleb Durbin could have only dreamed of playing for the Brewers someday while in the minor leagues in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, it's really cool because when I was playing in the Northwoods League in Fond du Lac, you know, I was a Division III player and playing against a lot of, you know, D1 and other divisions in that league, and that was a big opportunity for me, not really knowing if I would get a chance at the next level, but, you know, was able to get my foot in the door, and looking where I'm at now and being able to go back, you know, it puts it all in perspective.
That's the Brewers' Caleb Durbin. Game 2 of the NBA Finals is tonight. The Thunder host the Pacers, Indiana winning Game 1. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Not sure if Steve Carell has big feet, but his shoes will be tough to fill. No one knows that more than Domhnall Gleeson, who will play the boss on a new spinoff of NBC's The Office. The paper will feature the same documentary film crew from The Office, even though it was never really featured, as they record the daily happenings of a dying local newspaper, and it will be brought to you by the same team that brought you the American version of The Office. Gleeson, the son of actor Brendan Gleeson, knows the challenges he faces. The actor said he recently received encouraging words from Carell's Office co-star, John Krasinski, who reassured the actor that he was in great hands with executive producer Greg Daniels. Daniels successfully rebooted Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's show of the same title from the UK. Although the title is different, the challenges faced in the paper are the same faced by those who ran a fictitious paper company. There is no release date yet, but the paper will premiere in September on Peacock. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. For your Sunday, some showers and storms around, increasing clouds, highs in the upper 60s, and a light south breeze. For tonight, showers ending, then skies turning mostly clear with lows in the mid-50s. Another chance of showers and storms on Monday, highs near 70, currently 65 degrees.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
This is for people who watched me anchoring the news at Channel 13. My last day at TV 13 was 20 years ago yesterday.
Oh, I'm old now too.
Well, yeah, that was my whole point.
And I was too when you stopped working at TV.
That's what I get all the time now is people come up and they go, oh, were you on TV? I'm like, yeah. And then I go, don't say it. I watched you when I was a little kid. I'm like, yikes.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
Jay, Matt, Nair, and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, oil and gas industry expert Matt Randolph, also known as Mr. Global, will be here to talk about all things energy in Wisconsin. Don't miss it.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review, your weekly weekend review of all things rule of law related, justice related, government related. Right before the break, chatting with Ali, who called in to inquire very broadly, very appropriately about this movement on Capitol Hill to prevent federal district court judges, presumably like Judges Boasberg and Zinnes and Gallagher and Murphy and others in many other areas from doing their jobs, trying to restrict their jurisdiction through a couple of different mechanisms involving the contempt authorities of federal judges, bond requirements, all those kinds of things. Indeed, that's still out there. That is still very much out there. This is the interplay between the rule of law and legislation. Congress, an entity we have not spoken a lot about, but also involved in the rule of law. To Ali's good point, we know that just this past week, federal district court judge named Deborah Boardman, she's in Maryland, she temporarily blocked the Trump administration's wholesale dismantling of AmeriCorps. That's that independent federal agency that, what does it do? It facilitates public community service opportunities and reversing the termination of frankly, many, many grants, volunteer network capabilities across 24 different states. That just happened on Thursday of this past week. And once again, another district court judge, we've heard from her before, her name is Allison Burroughs, U.S. District Court, Massachusetts, once again blocking Donald Trump and the administration in his efforts to prevent Harvard University from enrolling international students. And that, of course, a part of the ongoing dispute, the fight, the battle between the administration and Harvard, all of that and many other cases involving federal district courts and the exercise of their authority. That, again, tying this all together, my attorney general, your Department of Justice has said federal judges have no capacity to do it in violation of the clear language, the clear meaning, the import of the Constitution of the United States of America. All of that going on in America. All of that, again, appreciating your comments, your questions. Let's go to Mark next. Mark, you've been on the line for a while. Your comment, your question, your inquiry this morning.
A couple of things. I'm concerned about what happens, what course of action citizens will have if their information is misused in this DOGE takeover our information, whether the presidential immunity or governmental immunity would apply if our information is stolen as a result of these guys having such access to it. Additionally, I find it somewhat bemusing, Pam Bondi's high dungeon over this man, Alberto Garcia's, that accusing him of sexual exploitation of women. And with Elon Musk's latest revelation that alleging that Donald Trump is in the Epstein files, and if Pam Bondi, because she's likely seen that information, if she's aware of anything, if Donald Trump is in those files, and if he has this evidence in those files that he did exploit or abuse women, especially young women, in those files, does she have any obligation to reveal that information, or is she actually going to suppress that information? Because if that information is exonerating of Donald Trump, it should actually be released. And if not, I mean, that we should know all the skeletons that are in those closets.
And Mark Wright, your points go to transparency once again, whether it's in the connection with a federal criminal action, a civil action, basically disclosures. The Department of Justice has an awful lot of obligation, again, to provide the population with information that is relevant to ensure its safety and security, just information to know about what government is and is not doing, all those things. Especially appreciate, Mark, just as you have followed up on the comments by Dale previously, this focus upon the Supreme Court case of just this past week involving the Musk team and the decision by the Supreme Court to give them the leave that they have been seeking, notwithstanding what lower courts have said, to get access to your Social Security information. Let's go to that right now. Again, the Supreme Court issuing what can only be considered a blockbuster ruling. Once again, the problems with it comes out of a decision that is not explained. It is about a 3 or 4 page statement by the majority, a 6-3 majority, basically saying we conclude that under the present circumstances, the Social Security Administration may proceed to afford members of the, I'm going to call it the Musk team, access to the agency records in question in order for those members to do their work. That is the most description we get from this Supreme Court about the reason why on this emergency application, this shadow docket application reversing the lower courts now as of late this past week, the Musk team, the vestiges of it, which continue to do work there in Washington, D.C., they can show up on Monday morning at the Social Security Administration with the imprimatur of your Supreme Court. Now, why is that important? Well, you know why that's important. And indeed, it is important as articulated by the dissenters, notwithstanding what the majority has said without explanation. The dissenters have chosen to be quite clear, and from the writings of Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor, we get an earful about why this decision is improper, following up not only upon the security issues that Mark and Dale and others, I suspect many of you, would articulate. Here's what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, with whom the others concur, say about this. She says, today the court grants emergency relief that allows the Social Security Administration to handle the staffers from Musk, the highly sensitive data of millions of Americans. The government states that it wants to give this entity unfettered access to this personal, non-anonymized information right now, before the courts have had time to assess whether that access is lawful. So, she says, the government asked the court to stay a lower court's decision to place temporary and qualified limits on this data access while litigation challenging this authority to the access is pending. And that's the point, right? Again, the underlying litigation is pending. We do not have resolutions of it. And Justice Jackson, as do the others, say, what is the rush? Why are we now exposing all of this information? What is the immediacy of this petition? And she goes on to say, the government fails to substantiate its stay request, this petition from the Department of Justice, by showing that it or the public will suffer irreparable harm absent this court's immediate intervention. In essence, the urgency, and she puts that in quotes, underlying the government's stay application is the mere fact that it cannot be bothered to wait for the litigation process to play out before proceeding as it wishes. Importantly, Justice Jackson and the others take the opportunity, as if it's not out there already, and it's important to note that while this has not become the law of the case, it is a part of the official records of the Supreme Court. She says the Social Security Administration and the sensitive data it collects are well known to Americans who entrust their information to that government agency. Social Security numbers, birth dates, addresses, bank account numbers, medical records, all of that and more is in the mix. Every person, the justice says, who has received a Social Security number appears in this data. And beyond the identification numbers and retirement benefits that bear the agency's name, the administration also administers a host of other programs, such as the Social Security Disability Insurance Program, which collects detailed medical history describing, for example, prescriptions, mental health treatments, and testing results for sensitive health conditions like HIV, all of that from applicants and beneficiaries. She talks at great length about the import of the Privacy Act to protect the privacy of individuals identified in information systems maintained by federal agencies. And says this, to protect against the significant privacy risks that the government's handling of Americans' sensitive information creates, the Privacy Act regulates federal agencies' collection, maintenance, use, and dissemination of that data. She goes on to say, in compelling language that every American should know, even though this is the losing decision, this is the losing side of this proposition, she goes on to say, it should come as no surprise then, the Social Security Administration has long followed a policy of restricting access to personal records the agency maintains consistent with the Privacy Act and similar laws. This is what the Social Security Administration has been doing since the time of its creation. Record evidence reflects that this Musk team received far broader data access from Social Security, customarily affording others based upon fraud, waste, and abuse reviews. In other words, going well beyond what the Social Security Administration already had to give to these folks. A former acting chief of staff at the SSA, according to the writing of the members of the Supreme Court, recounted that similar investigations typically, in his words, start with access to high-level anonymized data based on the least amount of data the analyst or auditor would need to know. And then only if suspicious entries appear would the reviewer then gain access to more granular, non-anonymized data limited to just that subset of files. This is a particularized explanation inside this dissent by the three justices to explain how the limitation of the Musk and Trump team was not complete, but was graded based upon the history of how this is done in the past. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson goes on to say, just last week, I wrote about the requirements for granting stay applications, and in particular, how this court's emergency docket practices were decoupling from the traditional harm reduction justification for equitable stays. She is complaining there once again about the fact that with great frequency, with great feverish speed, what are we seeing? Every single week, the United States Supreme Court issuing these major decisions that change the geography of our lives and our livelihoods based upon virtually nothing, at least not in the public domain, not getting the benefit of oral argument, not getting the benefit of presentations made to the Supreme Court, writings by lawyers. She goes on to say, with today's decision, it seems as if the court has truly lost its moorings. Let me repeat that. She says, with today's decision, it seems as if the court has truly lost its moorings. It interferes with the lower court's informed and equitable assessment of how the administration's data is best accessed during the course of this pending litigation. And it does so without any showing by the government. That's your Department of Justice. That's the attorneys. That's the Solicitor General in front of the Supreme Court, to the extent he was arguing about this at all. And he was. That it does so without any showing by the government that it will actually suffer consequences, concrete, irreparable harm from having to comply with the lower court orders. Why does the Musk team need immediate, unfettered, and unprecedented access to highly sensitive, non-anonymized data to accomplish its objectives? That's not me talking. That's the three members of the Supreme Court. The government answers were imprecise, contradictory, and insufficient. And when the court requested further clarification, the government passed. All of that in the dissent. Despite the government's poor showing, Ketanji Brown Jackson goes on to tell us as Americans, the district court still structured its injunction in a minimally burdensome manner from the government's standpoint, and goes on to describe that. The injunction permits the Social Security Administration to grant Musk and his team staffers access to discrete,
particularized and non-anonymized data. If the group there gives the agency a written explanation of its specific need for the records, in the end, the district court's order, which is now effectively vacated, at least while the litigation goes ahead, the district court order, the dissenters say, amounts to a short-term pause on giving Musk and his team unfettered and uniquely unprotected access to millions of Americans' sensitive, non...
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Summer. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We want to hook you up with $100 cash, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, and the chance to win a summer getaway to the Wisconsin Dells area or an escape to Door County. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store. Then listen in for the keywords during the 7 and 11 a.m. hour and 2 and 4 p.m. hour. Text in the keyword and get set to win. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed two election bills May 2nd, one of which includes provisions for poll workers to challenge the citizenship of voters in the polling place, a ban on ranked choice voting, and a higher bar for third parties. Among several new provisions, House File 954 authorizes state election officials to access federal agency databases and gives local election officials authority to challenge citizenship of a registered voter at the polls. A recent presidential executive order now allows access to those databases. If a voter is not able to provide documentation at the polls, they would be forced to use a provisional ballot. Only days before the 2024 election, the Secretary of State's office challenged the eligibility of over 2,100 registered voters. Most were naturalized citizens or data errors, while 277 were registered non-citizens. Of those, only 35 voted out of 1.7 million ballots cast. Pro-voter groups argue such mass challenges intimidate legitimate naturalized citizens from voting. Two provisions in 954 attempt to protect major party power. It bans ranked choice voting for any election in Iowa and raises the bar for third parties to field candidates. Third parties now need to garner 2% of the vote in three consecutive elections to qualify for the ballot. We have more on HF 954 at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns, it's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Wisconsin. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
Matt Nair on air.
Congressman Mark Pocan is here. Are you planning on going out on the road again, having a couple more town halls?
Yes. No, Claire. Derek and I have been invited by Opportunity Wisconsin, so I'm really looking forward to debating Derek. My guess is it's more likely I will sprout a head full of hair than he will show up. This is important to let people know what's in this bill, because there is a very good reason why Republicans are hiding from town halls.
Catch Matt Nair on air at its new time, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is our final segment of this two-hour broadcast this weekend of Amicus Law Review, noting with great concern what three members of the Supreme Court have noted just this past week in their dissenting opinions in this Social Security access case. Ketanji Brown Jackson writing in the end that the court today opts to relieve the government. That's your government. That's the U.S. Department of Justice. That is the White House. That is the officials responsible for this, relieves the government of the standard obligation, jettisoning, getting rid of careful judicial decision making, and creating grave privacy risks for millions of Americans in the process. That coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. Three other cases, unlike that one, which is decided, again, in a split decision, 6-3. Three other unanimous decisions, 9-0. Let's talk about those relatively quickly. We know that the Supreme Court on Thursday ruled that the Mexican government cannot sue U.S. gun manufacturers, holding them responsible, at least trying to do so, for violence committed by drug cartels in Mexico. Unanimous decision, this one authored by Justice Elena Kagan, holding that under the law, the court cannot, in fact, maintain a lawsuit that the Mexican government was, and finding the Mexican government is barred by U.S. legislation established by Congress that insulates gun makers from liability. Mexico, Justice Kagan wrote, had not plausibly argued that American gun manufacturers had aided and abetted in unlawful gun sales to Mexican drug traffickers. Mexico, out of luck in attempting to pursue its federal action here in the courts of America to seek redress for the things that American gun manufacturers have allegedly, causally done with respect to violence, cartel-related violence in Mexico. A second case, this one very important in terms of employment discrimination. Thursday, the Supreme Court unanimously, once again, 9-0. In this case, written by Ketanji Brown Jackson, ruling in favor of a straight woman who had twice lost positions to gay workers, saying that an appeals court, a lower court, had been wrong to require her, that is the petitioner here, to meet a sort of heightened burden in seeking to prove workplace discrimination because she was a member of a majority group. There's a lot to unpack there. And we know that the upshot of the decision written by Ketanji Brown Jackson, again for unanimous court, is that under the federal civil rights laws, Title VII, in which you can bring lawsuits based upon the terms and conditions of your employment, she said the burdens do not vary based on whether or not the plaintiff is a member of a majority group. In some lower courts, the courts had required that plaintiffs from majority groups prove an additional element as a part of their discrimination lawsuits if they lacked direct evidence of discrimination, particular background circumstances that support the suspicion that the defendant is that unusual employer who discriminates against the majority. That's a lot to unpack there. Basically, the Supreme Court saying that that background circumstances, additional burden imposed upon majority petitioners, does not, in fact, mandate that that level of proof be met. And in fact, everybody, majority or minority populations who are bringing lawsuits alleging discrimination, straight, gay, otherwise, immutable characteristics in this system, do not have a heightened burden of proof. Everybody, as Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote, for a unanimous court, is obliged to follow the same basic standards of proof in our trial courts. And finally, a case coming out of Wisconsin itself, the Supreme Court unanimously once again ruling that a Catholic charity in our home state here in Wisconsin is entitled to a tax exemption that was denied by the Wisconsin Circuit Court on the ground that its activities were not primarily religious. In this case, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that the state court had engaged in what she described as forbidden denominational discrimination. And again, the lower court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, had ruled that the activities, again, of Catholic charities were primarily charitable and secular and did not attempt to imbue program participants with the Catholic faith. The Supreme Court had said that the group employed and served people of all religions. That meant necessarily that they should be denied the tax exemption, even as it accepted the charity's contention that its services were based upon some biblical values and the principles of Catholic teaching. So there's a lot, once again, to unpack there. The Supreme Court saying, no, the Catholic charities here is sufficiently religious and faith-based in nature to qualify for the tax exemption, overturning the Wisconsin Supreme Court and finding that indeed the tax exemption should apply to them as well. Among the many cases, again, pending in front of the Supreme Court involving the interplay between religion and government, we know that there's another case pending even at this very time about whether parents in Maryland have a religious right to withdraw their children from classes when books, storybooks with gay and transgendered
themes are discussed. That will be decided in upcoming cases. We spoke in previous weeks also about this deadlock, that 4-4 deadlock in that case involving that Catholic charter school in Oklahoma that passed constitutional muster in Oklahoma but did not survive the Supreme Court because of the fact that it deadlocked, meaning that the lower court there in Oklahoma, its decision that the charter school could not, in fact, get federal funds, could not get state funds, could not get tax dollars, that the state court ruling against that school would, in fact, stand, and therefore setting no precedent by virtue of the 4-4 split, but nonetheless an important additional religious case. In the future, other cases coming up. We've got medical treatment for transgender minors, age verification rules for adult access to sites, and also birthright citizenship. All those things coming up in the next 2 to 3 to 4 weeks. As Amicus Law Review continues, we will take those cases up. We'll analyze them for you. We invite you to the discussion here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media as the work of the Supreme Court and all other branches of government continues in these United States of America. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. The day after immigration protests turned violent, this has been a quieter day in Los Angeles so far. KNX Radio's Pete Demetrio is at the Metropolitan Detention Center, the staging area for some 2,000 National Guard troops sent in by President Trump.
I would say 10 to 15 protesters, that's about it. They're occasionally shouting comments and statements that the guardsmen saying they're on the wrong side of history, or at least that's their point.
That spot was the scene of several confrontations yesterday and Friday. CBS's Brad Blackburn reports the feds are ready with reinforcements.
The Secretary of Defense said in a post on X that if National Guard troops, those initial 2,000, are not enough, more military members could be authorized, including active duty Marines from Camp Pendleton. That is if violence continues.
Both California's governor and the mayor of Los Angeles have said President Trump shouldn't have sent in the Guard, that their law enforcement agencies could handle.